in today's society.
Every time one died, the radio beeper within the collar works much like a self-winding wristwatch, to the extent that if there's absolutely no movement for over 6 or 7 hours, I think it is, the frequency, or the beeping frequency, changes in the beeper, and instead of going beep, 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 it goes to a bop, 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 which tells you that the animal has been laying absolutely still, at least for more than 7 hours. And when they mean still, it's just the slightest movement moves that thing enough to keep that from happening. So every time one would die, they would fly down there and try to figure out why it died. As I said, most of it was predator problems. So they set up these trip cameras to see how these animals were doing in the general vicinity where they'd been planted. I've got some still photos here I'll pass around. If you can find a rib on an animal, show it to me. These films were taken, most of them, the year after the first plant. You'll find several instances. There's single and twin calves following a cow elk. And these calves, of course, are born in the spring of the year when the elk that should be in the poorest shape they're going to be for an entire year. They've just come out of a tough winter. She's given birth to twins, and the twins are following around nursing behind her.
Senator?
Yes.
Could I interrupt for a minute? Could we, maybe, since we've got a quorum, we can call this meeting to order.
Sure.
We do have a quorum present. I'd like to call a meeting to order of the House Resources Committee. The time is 8:25 a.m., April 19th. Will the Secretary please call the roll?
Representative Williams?
Here.
Representative Hudson? Representative Bundy?
Here.
Representative Carney?
Here.
Representative Davies? Representative Finkelstein? Representative Green? Representative James?
Here.
Representative Mulder?
Here. We do have a quorum, and we are going to hear Senate Bill 43 on the transplanting of elk, and Senate Bill 46 relating to the moose farming. And I'd like to get through all the testimony today, but we will have our initial introduction on these two pieces of legislation and get through as much testimony as we can. We need to adjourn at about 9:50, so we plan to hear Senate Bill 43 until about 9, and then take up Senate Bill 46 for the remainder of the time. We are on teleconference today with Anchorage, Delta Junction, Fairbanks, Homer, Mattoon, Nome, Sitka, Kenai, and Craig. We begin with Senate Bill 43 on the transplanting of elk. The bill sponsor, Senator Adam Taylor, is here today. And did you want to start over, Senator? Or?
Thank you, Representative Williams, Chairman. I appreciate that very much, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here today with you and with your committee. I have prepared a rather lengthy sponsor statement, about 3 pages. I did that, and primarily this was done by my staff, Jerry Otness, has done an excellent job on this, to respond to some of the criticisms that have come out. I noted that you have Delta Junction on the teleconference this morning. I think that's wonderful. You see, had somebody not had the intestinal fortitude back when this state was under the management of the United States government, there wouldn't be any bison today in Delta. Now, you never hear anybody complain about those bison. In fact, I mean, I've never heard anybody say, oh, those bison are spreading disease. Oh, those bison are trampling on things. Those bison are eating up delicate and endangered flora and fauna species. I've never heard that. Heard a little complaint one time about Delta farmers with barley fields out there upset because the herd walked through their field once in a while, or maybe munched up some barley. I think it's wonderful that they transplanted those bison. In fact, it's so wonderful for our Department of Fish and Game, we charge $10 for a person just to apply to get into a drawing for a permit. You know how many people apply for every permit that's granted? It's about 800 people who apply for every permit that's granted. Yeah, pretty good sized moneymaker for every bison that they allow to be shot each year. Have the bison destroyed the environment? No. Have the bison endangered any species up there? No. I think the people of the Delta area would be very upset if the Department of Fish and Game decided, without notice to anyone, to eliminate every single bison by a year-round hunting season, wide open for any sex, any time of the day or night, any number you want to shoot, and start shooting them the 1st of July. That's what's happened because I passed this bill through the Senate. That's what my Board of Fish and Game did here in Southeast. They wanted to kill off every one of the animals you see on that video over there. I think that's incredible. Where were these same rocket scientists when it came time for the United States government to transplant muskox? Muskox. Is there anybody in here that would suggest that we have to go eliminate all the muskox, or that the muskox carry disease, or that the muskox is some evil animal that's going to trample down the delicate tundra? Heavens, no. They were transplanted. Did the muskox propagate to the place where they're killing off all the rest of the species up in that area? Are they like the rabbits being introduced into Australia? I mean, that's literally the testimony of my Department of Fish and Game, is that these elk will be like rabbits introduced to Australia, or starlings introduced to the East Coast. I don't think so. I think we as Alaskans are very proud to have muskox up there. We put the little muskox symbol on various things to reflect our state. We photograph them. The University of Alaska has spent millions just studying them. I think it's kind of wonderful that we have. There's an entire industry, cottage industry, just utilizing the fur off the muskox to weave it into some of the most delicate, beautiful wool you've ever seen. Wonder what they would have said today if somebody tried to introduce a bill to bring muskox to the state of Alaska. I tell you what they'd say. They'd say, oh no, those things might have liver flukes in them. Good grief, they might be carrying TB. They might be just filled with all sorts of evil diseases that are going to kill us all off. That's what the same people are saying today about the elk that we transplant. Funny thing though, in the 6 years of Representative Williams since those elk landed in Southeast Alaska, not one member of the Department of Fish and Game's taken any time to study them. They don't even know what they eat. They've never even gone down in all the time. If you wanted to look further at this video, you'll see in a couple places a fellow standing in the foreground with a antenna-like thing you use for tracking down beepers on these radio collars. That fellow standing in the foreground is our Fish and Game biologist out of Ketchikan. He was transplanted, or he himself was taken there by helicopter, about $1 million worth of helicopter, I might add, donated by Ketchikan Pulp Company. They were going to the area and they said, hey, how would you like to fly along? We know where the elk are, we'll show you the elk. You can go up, take a look at them for the day. Mr. Larson's gone up there several times on that helicopter just to look at these elk. Mr. Larson never once took the time to pick up any elk scat, put it in a plastic bag, stick it in his pocket, and take it back home and run it underneath a microscope to find out what the elk was eating, or to find out what his diet was like, or whether or not he was healthy. They've never taken the time to go down there and tranquilize dart one of them, to examine their stool, or to check their lungs, or to weigh one, to even find out what the average size is and whether or not they're gaining weight or losing it. That's in 6 years. Of course, that shouldn't surprise us. 1928-29, federal government transplanted elk and Sitka black-tailed deer onto a Fognak Island. That's only 66 years ago. Ask our department what they eat on a Fognak. They can't tell you. Almost 30 years of statehood, they've never studied that one either. Never studied Sitka black-tailed deer up there. How many Sitka black-tailed deer can you currently shoot in Southeast Alaska? Well, it all depends on whether or not it's an island that has wolves on it. If it's an island that doesn't have wolves, you can shoot 4. If an island where there is wolves, then you can only shoot 3. That's Prince of Wales. Only reason you can shoot 3 over there is because we've allowed the native people primarily, and their private lands have allowed significant amounts of logging, so has the National Forest, and the deer population exploded on Prince of Wales Island. Wolf population went down significantly with the advent of almost 8,000 people out there. People have a tendency to drive over wolves with trucks and shoot them on occasion, and a lot of people even enjoy trapping, and once in a while they get lucky and get a wolf. It has a major impact on the deer population. So we got lots of deer on Prince of Wales. Where don't we have deer? We don't have deer on the islands around Wrangell, Petersburg, etc., significant enough so that we can hunt more than one antlered buck per year. Under the careful management of my Department of Fish and Game, I went 7 years living in Wrangell where we couldn't shoot a deer if you wanted to. It was illegal. They've been so successful in their deer management policies. course, while the feds were managing it down there, you could shoot four. That went on for over 50 years, that you could shoot four deer in that area. Feds had a wolf control program. Let's examine just a couple of the things they've told you. Let me repeat. First thing you're going to hear testimony about is that they're going to spread disease, that there's these huge liver flukes. There's all kinds of other problems that these animals have, that they're an exotic species. Well, if that's the case, what about all these animals running around down there that they helped us plant just 6 years ago? But is that a bunch of diseased animals? Are they out there coughing and wheezing and having lung problems, TB problems? No. In fact, every single one of those animals was carefully examined by veterinarians in the states from which they came and by our own veterinarians in our own department to make absolutely certain they weren't bringing any diseases up here. We got a totally disease-free herd right there in front of you. It's a herd that has propagated to the place where we believe it runs between somewhere between 100 and, according to the department's numbers, 150 animals. I don't believe they're that high. I think it's closer to 120. The 150 animal number was given at a hearing over in about 3 weeks, a month ago. Are these animals exotics? I don't think so. Not if we've got 1,200 to 1,500 of them running around on a fog net. By the way, you might ask, well, if they planted, Senator Taylor, elk on a fog net, there were like 5 to 7 of them that they put on there back in the late 20s, and they planted deer about the same time, how are they doing today? Doing so well that our own Department of Fish and Game, up until this year, has allowed you to shoot 6 deer on a fog net. Now, if these elk are competing with them so viciously, eating up all the food that the poor little deer wants to eat, how come the deer outnumber the elk 10 to 1 on a fog neck island? They got to be tricky, those deer. Are they exotic? I don't think they were. I think if we actually knew what existed here prior to the last ice age, I think there were elk all over this country. In fact, that was the excuse used by the feds when they brought muskox back in here. They said that prior to the last ice age, they were just certain that muskox roamed the northern tundra. Funny, they're not using that now. They can't remember that logic. They don't want to talk about a fog neck. They keep wanting to say, oh, it's different somehow. I can tell you it is different. I've been out there, I've hunted elk and deer on a fog neck, and there is a significant difference. The elk on a fog neck are made up of the original 5 to 7 animals planted out there, so there's a very small genetic pool. Now, that genetic pool has had maybe two effects. One, it has bred the largest elk found any place in the world. There is no heavier bodied elk than the ones you find on a fog neck. So that's a good benefit from that limited genetic pool. The second aspect is they grow lousy horn. And we don't know whether that's because the current suspect is that it's because of lack of good mineralization in the soils. And because of that lack of good mineralization, they don't grow a good firm horn structure. They actually have kind of ugly horns. That's probably also because you've got a significant amount of volcanic ash and other things that cover up what mineralized rock may be available out there. Now, where did I get that information? Certainly didn't come off the top of my head. I got it from biologists that have gone out there and looked at these animals. I got it from biologists that have studied them and thought it was kind of neat to have some elk out there to study. None of them are going to be in here today. We're going to hear from biologists from our Department of Fish and Game, and you may even hear from some feds. I'll be shocked if you do, because they normally can't come over here and testify. At least that's the excuse they give when you want them to testify on something that has to do with logging. They have to get permission from Washington, D.C. The statements that they're going to give have to be approved by Washington, D.C. But when they want to testify against something, I guess it's no problem to write letters. Then you were told that the cost was going to be astronomical. You might ask, if you want to, and look into that fiscal a little bit, I would suggest at least that ask them how come they need $1.5 to $2 million now when they haven't spent any money studying them on a fog neck and they haven't spent any money studying them on Edelin in the last 6 years. Why the big numbers now? Why do you need $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 worth of equipment to go study them each year, the next 5? you weren't interested enough in studying over the first place. I didn't come in here today because this is some harebrained idea that I dreamed up. As the chairman can tell you, the Ketchikan Sportsmen's Association, Sitka Sportsmen's Association, Stikine Sportsmen's Association, have all lobbied hard and long for this legislation for years. We have been the recipient, going back 6-8 years ago, of petitions of over 1,200 signatures on. Many of them, by the way, came from Prince Wales Island. There have been other significant petition drives that were brought. We have petitions from Sitka, petitions from Prince of Wales, all requesting the same thing. Please give us some help. We'd like to have them here. We don't think they will do any damage, and we think it'd be nice to have as an alternative for those of us that enjoy hunting and enjoy viewing. Probably wouldn't be able to hunt them for many years. But there are some people that really believe that there's an advent to having animals out in the wild that you can actually view. People are quite thrilled when they see a bear. They're quite thrilled when they see a goat. That's another one, isn't it? Goats. Goats don't live in any of our islands in southeast Alaska because goats don't swim very good. And when the last ice age came along, the only goats that were left over on the mainland. Funny, isn't that? Fish and Game was allowed us to transplant goats just 2 years ago. I went down and we did it completely voluntary because the Ketchikan Sportsmen had asked for it, many other clubs had asked for it. We assembled $7.5 million worth of equipment, over 50 volunteers, and the only people getting paid on the job that day were Fish and Game officers and Forest Service people. Everybody else was volunteering their time to get those We think it's a good idea. We'd like your help. We can show you that it has succeeded. We can show you that it hasn't hurt the deer, one iota. We can even show you a doctoral thesis, the most recent study done, out of the state of Washington, studying the interaction between elk and deer around Mount Rainier. The conclusions of that doctoral thesis are that there's somewhat of a symbiotic relationship between the two, and to the extent that deer find themselves near elk herds, they probably have a better chance of surviving predation. But I know many of you have been concerned about the possibilities of some of these evil things occurring that the department has suggested. I would not be here if I believed for a moment that one of those evil things was possible. The history of Apognak Island does not bear that out. The history of the Edelin Island plant does not bear that out. In fact, both of them run directly counter to the conclusions reached. I'd ask if there are any questions. I'm not going to read a statement to you that's been prepared. I hope you will read through that. I really find it offensive when somebody reads a statement to me that I can read.
Representative Mulder.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Senator Taylor, for being here today. Questioning the seemingly out of whack fiscal note that Commissioner Rozier submitted, what are your comments about that, Senator Taylor, relating to $415,000 or thereabouts for the first 3 years and then $87,000 thereafter? Does that seem a little bit out of line to you?
Well, you know, interestingly enough, it'd be easy to take a cheap shot and just say, well, that's all they're doing is trying to bury the thing with a huge fiscal note. But you know, personally, I'd like to see them spend that much money on it. I really would. I'd like to see them actually go out, do some field work, put somebody on the ground, not just one of these armchairs, sit behind a desk rascals. I want somebody that goes out in the field, lives in the mud and the dirt just a little bit, and finds out what they're talking about. I'd kind of like that. I really would. I don't mean just somebody to get into 185 and fly around with their little sack lunch because it's convenient for the day to go look at the elk. I would really appreciate somebody actually doing the work. And then I'd appreciate them coming back and telling us what they found in their studies. What does an elk eat on Edelin Island? What does a deer eat? What's the average weight? How do they interact together? How do they act around predators? Only way you can say something like that, you see, is if you get on the ground and you spend a considerable period of time observing those animals. So, yeah, I'd kind of like that. But can we afford that? No. Not with the other priorities we've got. I would have thought, though, at some time in the last 30-plus years, they might have just spent a little bit to go look at the elk they already had. They've chosen not to, so I can't tell them.
Representative.
What would you consider, Senator Tarr, to be a more reasonable fiscal note? What is your guesstimation? What is it going to cost to transplant the elk?
The entire cost of transplanting the animals has been volunteered by the Sitka, Stikeen, and Ketchikan Sportsmen's Association, period. They will raise the money.
So if the fiscal note were removed, the program and the legislation were passed, it could still go on, the program would still go on?
Definitely. I don't need a fiscal note because the volunteer effort is more than there to provide the funding necessary to transplant all of these animals. And that's why the only thing this bill does, Representative Mulder, is authorize the transplant. It would actually take a second piece of legislation to fund and appropriate monies out of the general fund or from whatever source. It would actually take another separate, complete bill. You could include that in the budget. Be included in a capital budget or a supplemental bill or whatever. But the last time we did this, it took two bills. And we ran it through as a separate appropriation bill just for elk. So it's a two-shot thing. I don't believe we're going to need to do the second bill because if we have authorization, there's sufficient interest out there and more than enough support. The people in our district are happy to bear the burden of paying the cost. We believe the cost will be around $1,000 to $1,200 per animal. That's what the last one cost us.
Representative Finkelstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Could you use the microphone, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Of the fiscal note, $1 million of it is just the cost of moving the animals, right? You keep referring to the research part, which is 560 over 6 years. 6 years, so less than $100,000 a year, but that's $1 million. And and apparently it's based on the cost of moving the elk to Edwin Island in the first place. They just adjusted it for inflation. So I'm not sure how we can say it's so unreasonable because that appears to be the past cost of exactly what happened. I guess the question I have though is, assuming somehow, you know, that these folks want to cough up $1 million, which would be great, you know, if this was a good idea. It sort of amazes me we'd have a situation where we'd pass an authorization and somehow Fish and Game wouldn't be involved. Because I guess that's what I get out of this is that, and maybe, you know, someone along the line can correct me if there's some other opinion on this, but this bill has got the power to completely override the board of game. It just worries me quite a bit. If then anybody who's got the money can go and pass whatever it takes, you know, they've got all approval to do whatever they want. I think it's sort of scary. It might be that these laws stay in the books for decades, I mean forever. And that would mean, you know, 20 years from now when maybe something more information has come in from Edwin Island or some other place, we then know that it's a bad idea, they'd still be authorized to go do it with no actions of the Board of Game. If that's the case, I'm a little scared because I think that'd be a terrible precedent for Fish and Game management. And maybe you have some perspective on this I'm missing, but it certainly worries me.
I appreciate that, Representative Finkelstein, and believe me, it would worry me too if there was any truth in that. In fact, there's no way, the mere authorization by the legislature does not allow some Yahoo redneck to run out here into the state of Oregon with a pickup truck and lasso a couple elk and throw them in the back of his truck and drag them up the road and kick them loose in southeast Alaska. That isn't what happens. You still have to go through the entire permitting process with our Department of Fish and Game. You still have to have every one of these animals checked out by a biologist in the state from which they come, or they can't be transplanted out of that or moved out of that state. The question of whether or not the animal is disease-free gets resolved a couple different times before you ever get to the place of moving into a transplant. So you're only talking disease-free animals, or the department won't allow the permit to be issued. Secondly, where are the animals going to be planted, and who's going to regulate those animals? Very same policy, very same boards regulating them right now. Our Board of Game regulates the number of elk that can be shot every year on Fognak Island. That's how they manage that herd. Other than the fact that, according to Senator Zaroff, last time they flew out there with a helicopter, about 3 years ago, they ran 70 of them off a cliff, killing them. It may be a lie, I don't know. We've never been able to prove whether your people did it or not. The hunters on Fognak Island that were approaching the herd at the time swore they knew who it was. Nobody wants to listen to them, they're not biologists.
Are there any more questions for the senator?
Nick, Mr. Chairman, I just somehow think you're missing the point. I just was repeating your own words that this project will be authorized. And if it's authorized, it stays authorized for decades, and it may not be, it may or may not be a good idea now. I don't believe it's a good idea, but it certainly may not be a good idea in the future. And legislating authorization for this kind of thing, when we've got a board of game to do it, is just a bad idea. Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Let me just say one thing in response to that. The gatekeeper is still always there, Representative Finkelstein. This does not override the gatekeeper. And the gatekeeper is the Department of Game. They're the ones that are going to decide where the animals come from, whether or not they're permitted, whether or not they're allowed, and whether or not they're allowed in that given area. We have authorized it to take place, but it still has to go through the same processes.
Representative Mulder.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I share Senator Taylor's feelings in the sense that it wouldn't be the first time that the Board of Fish or Game, the Board of Game, has taken action, which I don't think the legislature necessarily intended them to take. I think it's, you know, fully within our scope of responsibility and authority to give them direction, to tell them, hey, I think you missed the boat here, or I don't think you're keeping up with the times. Certainly, while has nothing to do with Muldoon at the same time, transplanting elk on the Fognak didn't either, but I certainly know there are hunters from Anchorage that enjoy going down there. And I don't perceive any problems there either. I think this is just a question of whether we're going to expand our resources or whether we're going to be afraid and stay status quo. I noticed, Senator Taylor, that you have in the backup, the fiscal note says that there will be an elk transplanted in four locations in Southeast, but also that Commissioner Rozier is saying that, or citing that inadvertently, some elk that were transplanted at Edelin Island also caused inadvertent introduction to Sorembo Island and also perhaps Prince of Wales. Has that ever been further documented?
Yes. It's my belief they're probably on seven islands right now and maybe even on the Cleveland Peninsula.
Good swimmers?
Yep. Very healthy animals, very strong, good swimmers. And they've learned something about wolves, so they're surviving. There hasn't been one ounce of help, I might add, out of this department as far as making certain that those animals did survive. They're doing this on their own. And of course, the department's response is, oh my God, look at that. They actually swam right off the island. Let's go shoot them all. Either that or let's put them back in the test tube because we haven't had a chance to study them yet. Nobody's given us special additional monies appropriated to us to go study them.
Representative Carney.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just twice you've referred to fish and game shooting animals. And I missed the first time I was reading something, didn't pay close attention. Are they actually eliminating animals in some areas?
No, but I think you're going to hear from a member of the Department of Fish and Game that helped draft a resolution placed in front of our game board at the Anchorage meeting, at least according to the three friends of mine that were sitting in the meeting that he was present. And that resolution started off, interestingly enough, where the guys out of Ketchikan, having watched this herd for some time, seen how successful it was, they wanted to use a one elk permit, a drawing kind of a permit thing, for public education, to use it maybe as a fundraiser for the department or whatever, just to have one animal harvested, and then they could at least take a look at it, study the animal's jaw removed, whatever they do, you know. That's what the local guys wanted to do down in Ketchikan. So they put in, through their local advisory board, that's the normal process, a little resolution asking that they be allowed to one drawing for one elk to be harvested. That got in front of the game board. They used that to totally twist the whole thing around, came up with a resolution utilizing all the same scare tactics that our department's been throwing out recently. And what came out of it? Open hunting season beginning July 1 on any elk found any place other than Zarembo or Edelin Island. Shoot as many as you want, any sex, any amount, year round. So I asked the chairman of the board, who called me that evening, because he'd heard I was upset, he called me, I said, how are you going to determine when the elk comes into town and strapped across the bow of somebody's boat, which island it came off of? Well, that might be a little hard to figure out in police, he said. I said, no, it won't. What you've said is you're going to kill off and eliminate every single elk in southeast Alaska, and that's your goal. He said, it would have that effect, wouldn't it? I said, it sure would. I'd appreciate it if you rethought that policy of yours. And by the way, where did this all come from? Who gave this to you? Well, it just came up right there at the board meeting. Funny, it came up all typed up and handed to him by one of our fish and game officers. Interesting. What they didn't know was there were three people from Wrangell sitting there in the audience that had paid their own way up there to talk about other matters and watch this whole thing go on. One fellow from Juneau, same thing. He came into my office just after the big hoorah, you know, about Taylor makes board reverse its policy and all the press. He said, unfortunately, he said, Robin, you were absolutely correct. That's exactly what was going on. He said, that entire board up there ought to be thrown out for what they were doing. He said, I've never been so disgusted in my life. Watch them in action. That was a local state employee who paid his own way to fly from Juneau to sit in a motel room up there and watch these guys because he's concerned about fish and game management in his area. Didn't know a thing about elk. Wasn't concerned about elk. Didn't go up there to fight for elk. Didn't have a position on elk. That's what he told me. He worked for us right across the street. So yeah, were they trying to kill him off? You'd bet. And they will again. This won't be the first time.
Representative Finkelstein.
Mr. Chairman, just to make a request, I don't know if we have any of our legal affairs staff present, but the dialogue I had earlier with the sponsor comes down to basically whether this bill is mandatory, which is what I assert, or whether this bill is discretionary. He believes it's discretionary, and Fish and Game has the power later to, by permit, not allow these things. And I think I'd like to have someone from our legal affairs department at some point tell us whether the word shall within 3 years transplant not fewer than 75, not more than 11 elk, whether that's discretionary or whether that's mandatory. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Taylor, I have a question. You know, we've been going through this budget cutting process here for quite some time, and it seems like every time we do cut the budget or we try to get spending under control, it's always the field people that get cut. And now the Senate has cut the fish and game budget quite a bit. And now we're going to get into the same position that you've been talking about all morning, about how the fish and game hasn't had made any attempt to study the elk. And I know as a timber owner that when we start cutting the DNR, we only have one timber person down there in Ketchikan to support the private lands in the Ketchikan area, the private lands and the state lands on Prince of Wales and throughout that area. And that poor guy is running all over and a lot of the things that are happening. Would any of this type of cuts that we've been having in the past would any of the cuts that we've had in the past be and the fish and game not attending to the elk that we have on that island, not getting enough information, would that be part of the cause or that we have to have these cuts? Or?
No, I wouldn't suggest that at all. I'm not sure how they drew up their priorities over the last 30-some years. I'm not at all sure about that. As to who made the selection of what things they would study and what things they would not study. Unfortunately, they've chosen not to study these animals. That was an intentional thing, as far as I'm concerned. Now, they may have felt that they didn't have sufficient funds within their budget, but they never requested any either for additional funding for that purpose. So they established that priority. I did want to indicate that the mandatory nature of this legislation, as asked by Representative Finkelstein, is that they shall do it. No question about that. But they control all the gates as to whether or not it is permitted or not. That saying shall to them does not mean they shall bring up a bunch of disease-ridden animals and turn them loose. Saying shall does not mean they shall not manage them in the future and manage the other species. I think many of us would just like to see them start doing some active, intensive game management in the state anyhow, instead of this passive stuff of sitting back behind their desk and asking for another $100,000 for another study next year, and then now carrying it out. The entire cost of that goat transplant was paid by volunteers, and we even had to pay for the salaries of the people that were there and the drugs that they were using to tranquilize and wake up the animals. They're the ones that paid for the radio collars that we put on the animals. So I think a lot of these things can be done through volunteer effort, and when you do that, you end up with the community having a much greater stake in what's going on also.
Representative Bunny.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Taylor, a couple of things that, thank you, Mr. Chairman, a couple of things that were addressed in our package, and I've asked you to speak to them. One was, how would elk fit into the subsistence issue? Would it be a subsistence animal, and how would it affect, what would the impact on subsistence? The other item that was addressed was that they felt there weren't any surplus elk in the lower 48 to, you know, if there isn't a supply, I guess the whole question's moot, but if you could address those two.
Sure, thank you. Number one, they are not a subsistence animal in southeast Alaska because they've never been customarily and traditionally used as a subsistence animal, and that's the standard by which we determine whether or not something is either within or without the subsistence area. The question then, I think the real tough question is, if in fact elk impact deer, and deer are a subsistence animal, then is that a negative or a positive impact? The department will tell you that it may be negative, they don't know, but they're afraid. My suggestion is that if it's negative, there's been some real magic going on Fog Neck Island. I would love to be able to say 10, 15, 20 years from now to the people of southeast Alaska that you can now go out and everybody under subsistence or sport hunting can go out and harvest 6 deer per person, either sex, on the islands of southeast Alaska. And you can do it because at least there's a bunch of elk out there moving around, keeping trails open, and do a few things, maybe as far as wolf is concerned, by moving in a herd. I think that's beneficial. Are there elk available? I'm assured that there are out of the Jewel Meadow herd in Oregon, where we just where we got about half of these animals. I just met, in fact, about 3 weeks ago with the senator from Astoria, who assured me of that.
On that point, if I may, on the subsistence issue, I know that they take bison as a subsistence thing up in the Wrangles, and that was certainly not traditional. So we might want to look into that a little further.
Well, I don't think that's going to really be a problem for many years out into the future. Maybe at that time, customary and traditional might include elk. And personally, I'd have no problem with that as long as proper game management's going on and we have good viable herds and good sustained yield coming off of both deer and elk off the forest. I think that would be great, really. I'd have no problem with that.
Senator, we have, I think what we'll do is go on this list. We have about 20 people that want to testify on this, and we're not going to be able to get through all of them today, I'm sure.
I understand.
We have David Kellyhouse from AFDG. I think we'll hear from him. And I don't know how we're going to deal with this. Other people that want to testify. Could you state your name for the record who you represent, please? Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. My name is Dave Kellyhouse. I'm Director of Division of Wildlife Conservation. I don't think I have ever been as upset as I am right now due to some of the allegations that were just laid down against my department. I want to assure everyone here that the people in my division are some of the finest professional wildlife biologists that occur anywhere in the Northern Hemisphere. And if we express concern to you over bringing in what is indeed an exotic species, the elk did not occur here, it is an exotic, our concerns are valid. Our concerns basically are competition for food resources between elk and deer. We have a basis for this concern based on research that was conducted in the Northwest and the Rocky Mountain states and in British Columbia. The study that was referred to by the sponsor was strictly a behavioral study to determine whether there was dominance over deer by elk. It had nothing to do with how those two animals interact in the wild. In fact, the chief research by our chief game management biologist in British Columbia has said quite clearly that he believes that the potential competition between these particular elk and Sitka black-tailed deer, these studies would have to be done prerequisite to further introductions. We believe that the first introduction done in 1987 was quite possibly a mistake. Insofar as, number one, they weren't just Roosevelt elk, they were Roosevelt and Rocky Mountain elk, which are not adapted to the Sitka system. We spent most of the money that was dedicated to subsequent study of these animals just to get the animals moved in here because of the high expense of getting the animals moved in. It has been virtually impossible to study competition between the elk and the deer because the densities of both elk and deer are so low, you would not expect to see that competition resulting yet. However, we do have a study of food habits that we're going to be conducting. Our recommendation is that this legislation not pass until we can determine and quantify the relationship between deer and elk. Deer and elk on Fognak Island have crashed over 50% in the last 4 years. Area biologist Roger Smith has been there over 20 years as area biologist, and he feels that there is competition between deer and elk on Fognak. He said, in his opinion, if this is being done to enhance hunting opportunity, it's a mistake because deer will outproduce elk for hunting purposes 10 to 1. You can harvest approximately 3 to 4 deer per square mile per year in a productive population, whereas with elk, you're down to about a third of an elk. Hunter success between the two species, hunter success on deer is about 85%, hunter success on elk is about 15%. We do not believe this is going to help hunting opportunity. On Fognak Island, which was referred to quite often, you don't have wolf predation, and that's one reason that elk and deer have prospered on a Fognak, because you don't have the wolf in the system. When you put an alternate prey species at a lower level than they would naturally, so we have this whole predator-prey interaction. Specifically, we would not have opposed muskoxen reintroductions for what it's worth. We have, in fact, done more transplants. We are proposing a wood bison reintroduction because the animals were native here. It was stated that we have not studied elk. We have flown elk annually on a Fognak Island so as to set hunting regulations. As far as running 70 of them over a cliff, that is an allegation. It's unsubstantiated and it's not true. I think I better just stop right now because we just feel that that we do need time to study the Edelman transplant. Oh, one other thing, what the Board of Game did was consistent with the management plan that was drafted in 1986, which said that the elk would be put on an Edelman Island, and any elk that ventured off of Edelman Island would be captured and put back onto the island, or there would be a hunting season opened so that elk would be prevented from spreading off of Edelman to other parts of Southeast. And it is true that they do disperse widely. We're just saying that if indeed this turns out to be injurious to our native wildlife, we want to at least have it contained to one island so that then we can make a decision as to whether it's a good or a bad thing. And our uncertainties are well-based, I think. Thank you.
We have some questions. Representative Carney.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to question you a little bit about Fognak Island. You mentioned that there's been a decline in the last 4 years. You also mentioned that deer outnumbered elk So I don't make the connection between those numbers and the competition for 4-H.
Deer do outnumber elk. In almost any system where deer and elk are together, deer will generally outnumber the elk. They're a smaller animal, and you can just, you know, with that biomass on the land, you can have more individuals. Roger Smith, the area biologist on Apognic, said that as the elk expanded into new areas, there was a noticeable decline in deer abundance in those areas relative to areas that elk were not using. And like I said, he has been in the field, not behind a computer, for 20 years. He's probably one of the best field biologists we have.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And then the idea of having an open season on the elk, if that is one area, won't that have the effect of allowing people to harvest indiscriminately the animals on the area where they're supposed to be?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carney, that regulation was taken off the book by the board within 3 days after it was passed. We do not view that regulation much differently than you would by having different hunting seasons in adjacent areas. The management plan called for increasing the elk on Edlin Island to 250 before instituting a harvest, and providing that the elk would not leave that island, and that's what the board did. With a 1 elk back limit. It was not intended to eliminate elk on Edlin or Zarembo Island.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're concerned with a discussion here about how much the analysis of an unlimited basis in Alaska. Are you familiar, I'm just asking this as a point of interest, if elk came from Oregon, where they also have deer, and another elk and deer in Colorado, how do they get along there?
Those areas have native populations of both elk and deer. Generally have mule deer and Rocky Mountain elk, or Colombian blacktail deer and Roosevelt elk. What we have up here is the northernmost natural extent of range of deer. It's a Sitka blacktail deer. The reason they're able to be here is because of their unique food habits. They feed on small dogwoods and golden thread. These are very herbaceous plants that grow under old growth timber. In the lower 48, deer are primarily browsers, while elk are primarily grazers. As you get further north into Vancouver Island and then up into southeast, there has been some limited investigation of food, and elk and deer are obligated to use the same food plants here in Alaska, whereas there's what we call niche separation in their native range. We believe there's more overlap here in Alaska, and that's what we have to study to see what the impact of elk is going to be on deer, both through competition for forage and by introducing an alternate prey species into the system. We are sending some people out to an elk conference. I wasn't going to send anybody, but in view of this legislation, I decided to send two people out.
Mr. Chairman, if I could follow up, then I don't mean this facetiously, but where we have had both on a Apognic without wolves, they are still competing for the same forage there. Wolves don't have anything to do with that kind of forage, do they?
That's absolutely correct. There are no wolves there. The relationship on Apognic is fairly simple. It's just competition for food. And the two animals, unless you have a bad winter, the elk will generally seek out the meadows and such, whereas the deer are primarily browsers. What we're concerned about in southeast Alaska is the deep snows and the fact that the two animals are going to have to compete for forage in a more limited area.
Representative Bundy?
The area that I'm most familiar with is the Olympic Peninsula and the deer and elk relationship there. It's been a long time since I've been there. Would that be the most similar relationship to the southeastern islands, the old growth timber, Olympic Peninsula sort of area for elk and deer relationship? I'm looking for comparison studies of the relationship of deer and elk, and would the Olympics be the closest to stopping?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bundy, I don't know whether it would be the most similar. I suppose it would be the most similar, but it's certainly not going to be exact. We feel some of the work done in Vancouver Island which is the northernmost extent of elk distribution, after electric elk distribution, would probably be the most similar. And a lot of the material we've received from the British Columbia government.
On Vancouver, they have, Mr. Chairman, is that Columbia blacktail or that?
That's a Columbia blacktail. See, we have a Sitka blacktail, and they are different. They do have different food habits and such.
Representative Carney?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the, why hasn't Fish and Game done more studies of this transplant that's approved?
As I said earlier, Mr. Chairman, Representative Carney, one of the reasons is there's so few animals right now, and the island's so big, you would not expect to see competition at these low densities. In other words, our studying or monitoring would be more accurate. It's been limited to monitoring the radio collars for distribution, dispersal off of Ellen Island and habitat. But to be able to study the animals for competition, a Fognak would be a better site. Now, the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation has given us several thousand dollars initially to study elk on Fognak Island, elk and deer relationships. And we're trying to decide right now, negotiating with the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, whether to utilize the money there or on Edelin Island in view of this legislation in the southeast. It's a matter of priorities. You know, we don't have a big research arm. I mean, the impression seems to be that I have a cast of hundreds or something, and I don't. I probably have two dozen research biologists. Most of the people are management biologists. And what they do is enumerate the animals to set hunting seasons. And our research biologists have been detailed to studying native species, you know, which is a much greater concern to us than an exotic. Again, the situation on Edelin Island has not developed to the point where it's going to give any definitive answers on competition between elk and deer because of the low density. We feel that when and if these problems develop, probably none of us are going to be here at that point. It's probably going to be 30 years down the road when they build up the densities high enough to cause the problems. But our concerns are valid because of, you know, reports from other jurisdictions.
One final thought, Chairman, let's assume for purposes of discussion that this did occur, that the Constitution proves that the elk are out-zooming deer getting much worried. Wouldn't it be possible to control that by hunting regulations?
Possibly. Elk, as anybody will tell you that's hunted elk are a very difficult animal to deal with, I mean to hunt. They're wary, their senses are good, and what we're talking about is heavy timber cover. It would not be very easy to take the elk out of the system once they hit all these different islands and populated. It would be a monumental problem and it would be very expensive. I'm not sure whether it would be possible or not.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Mulder?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's nice seeing you back again, Dave. Obviously, it's a tough issue for you guys. Done some wars over it, it sounds like. You mentioned before that the Board of Game had drafted that policy. Mm-hmm. Have they ever adopted it in relation to reducing or diminishing the population on any other islands other than Edelin and Zirimbo?
They indeed did pass a resolution on elk in southeast. And what the bottom line on the resolution is that the elk should be maintained on Edelin and Zirimbo and prevented from spreading onto the mainland or Prince of Wales or the other islands. And as far as the allegation that we drafted that, we did not draft this. The board themselves drafted this. We did not hand this to them for their consideration. That we gave them a report on timber and elk and deer situations in southeast, which they had requested a year before, and they drafted their own policy on it.
Just to follow up, it seemed that earlier, Dave, that you implied that when they were actually transplanted there at the time, that had been their policy. Was that the case? I mean, when the deer or elk were transplanted there, was it ever thought about the fact that they might migrate?
In 1986, there was a management plan developed for the elk prior to the introduction. And one of the provisions was that the elk would be contained on Edelin Island. And they would be, you know, that was something that was agreed to up front. And that's all the board was doing. Because of the spread of elk onto Mitkoff and some of the other islands, the board passed that regulation to open up the season, year-round season, with a one-elk bag to actually live up to the provisions of the management plan passed in 1986. So it wasn't anything brand new that the board did.
And just as a final wrap-up, I'd concur with Representative Carney. I think it would be a fairly highly sought-after permit to be able to go in and actually, you know, if we had a management plan, we had to diminish the amounts or numbers. I think it'd be fairly highly sought after. It seems pretty logical to me.
Representative Finkelstein?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Taylor, you've been involved in fish and game management issues for a number of years, if my number is correct. And other than this elk issue, in what situations has the legislature ever legislated this kind of specific action? I mean, we obviously get involved in subsistence and various issues where we're setting broader guidelines. This kind of thing where it's got to be X number of elk with an X number of time and X number of locations in legislation by a bunch by the legislative body. Where else has this gone on besides elk?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Finkelstein, I'm not aware of this specific type of edict, except in 1987, when basically the legislature decided that we would put elk into Southeast Alaska, and that was over the objections of the department. And the concerns we had then are just as valid. You know, nobody's saying that elk aren't going to do well. My fear is they're going to do so well that we're going to run into the competition problem. I mean, they're just prospering.
Representative Bundy?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This may follow on with your statement there. I have mixed feelings about, I mean, I hunted the Olympic Peninsula, and it's very difficult, and in the rainforest, and elk were very difficult for an outsider, a newcomer, to hunt at least. But I also was in Ketchikan in the early 60s when they tried to transplant some on Gravina Island, and a homesteader took exception to their browse pattern, and he killed them all. There were half a dozen or whatever, and he didn't have trouble eliminating because they were eating in his garden. So I mixed a few things on how they might be able to be hunted. You quoted a study from British Columbia. Now, we got a ton of information. Could we get a copy of the DRL studies that exist to add to our entertainment? And I got a rambling question here, Mr. Chairman. And the Fog Neck Island, deer crashed there a while ago, I think you said. And if we get some information, or maybe right now, what are the seasons and what, you know, what was the, you know, what caused the crash, or you have some fairly good ideas of what the crash
deep
is
snow winters.
And how does it relate to hunting at this
yeah,
point?
Deep snow winters precipitated the decline. 87 was the peak year for deer and elk on a Fog Neck, and then a series of severe winters tipped both of them over. We went from about 1,500 elk down to about 800, and as far as numerically on the deer, we realize that the density has declined, but we can't put an actual number on it as we can the elk. In answer to your question, yes, I can find out what the impacts were on hunting seasons and bag limits on a Fog Neck Island, and yes, we can provide the Resource Committee with copies of all the information that we have. It's about 2 inches thick. So if you want to curl up next to a fire for a week or two, you'll be plenty of reading material.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative James.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Kellyhouse, I have a kind of a series of questions here, and I'll give you my questions, and then you can kind of come up with the answers. First, the statement is it is surprising to me that you don't have the answers that you say you don't have the answers for. It seems to me like with all the technology and all the intensive game management that we have done, that you don't know what the elk eat, and you don't know what the deer eat, and you don't know whether the elk is going to be challenging the deer, and you have to wait and see to see whether the deer dissipate faster. I know that deer and elk don't eat the same. I came from Oregon where I did deer hunting and elk hunting, and I know in times when we had extra amount of snow, we weren't allowed to feed the deer because we didn't have anything we could feed them, but we could feed elk hay, and they ate it. So I know they eat different things. I guess that what I'm asking you is, why don't you know what the elk eat and the deer eat? And why don't you have some kind of a calculation that says that we can have this many elk to this many deer? And then, if you did know that, why can't that protection of the deer population be done by intensive game management like you do on other species?
Mr. Chairman, Representative James, we don't know specifics. We know generally what the food habits are. We haven't studied it intensively because there hasn't been the need for it on a Fognak Island. The animals are self-contained. They were put in 1928, and there just hasn't been a need to do that level of detailed study on the island. On Edlin Island, again, the animals are so low density right now that we don't expect to see that kind of competition for several years. Where you're referring to down the lower 48, like I said, the two animals are native, and they have quite wide niche separation. As I said earlier, deer are browsers, elk are grazers, as you pointed out. When you get up into this ecosystem here, you see the deer, while they do browse, the reason they're able to inhabit areas this far north is because they're also grazers and they get very nutritious herbaceous forage. That's why we have concerns with the Sitka black-tailed deer and introduced elk. I wish I could, with all the high technology and everything, I wish I could push a button and have the answers. We're going to initiate some studies now, basically in response to this legislation, and push by Ketchikan Sportsman to introduce elk. One thing I forgot to say in testimony, and that was that the Board of Game passed a resolution opposing this legislation. The Sitka Fish and Game Advisory Committee voted unanimously to oppose it also.
And just one follow-up then, and knowing, having hunted deer and elk myself, I know that there's much more challenge in hunting elk, and you indicated that there was much more challenge in hunting elk. And in a state where we have sports hunting as one of our prime recreational areas, why shouldn't we encourage that kind of population for the sports hunters?
We have 14 species of big game in this state. We're so fortunate to have a wide variety of naturally occurring native game species. I'm all for the hunter. I've been a hunter all my life, and gosh only knows if I've gotten in trouble, it's been for promoting that. We believe that the effects of this could be just the opposite, that it could, in the long term, diminish hunting opportunities rather than expand them. And we just feel it's bad policy at this time to be putting exotic species in that could disadvantage our natives.
Thank you. I'm going to take one more, and I'm sorry we have about 15 or 20 people that want to give public testimony on this. And I'm sorry we will not be able to get to the public testimony today. I will have Senator Taylor make his last few comments at this time.
Oh, I wanted to thank you for giving us the opportunity to have this hearing today and for the patience of the committee. First, let me state the management plan that has been testified to has never been formally adopted. Secondly, the studies provided to the board on elk and timber from which they drew up their resolution, I'd like to see a copy of that study, because you see, I've been asking this department for any studies at all that it had for a lengthy period of time. And Mr. Kellyhouse, the commissioner, have been in my office at least three times when I asked to have those studies put on my desk. I haven't seen that study yet. It's incredible to me to hear testimony from my Department of Game Management that they would be unable to manage elk herds in southeast Alaska if they grew to some large size. That's an incredible statement. If in fact they're not able to manage ungulates in southeast Alaska, maybe that is a truer statement than I realized. Those of us that hunt Sitka black-tailed deer would certainly give high testimony to your inability to manage that species. Elk crashed from 1,500 to 800 on a Fognak Island due to winter kills, is what you've been told. There's management for you. This is a herd you're not able to do anything with. If they got too large, you wouldn't be able to find them or hunt them or chase them down with helicopters or anything else to control them. Couldn't even turn the hunting population loose to control them. But we don't know what the numbers were on deer on Fogback Island at the same period of time. Yet testimony before the board just this last year was that deer outnumber elk 10-1. The very same board that was informed of this huge crash 4 years ago allowed the same amount of deer to be harvested each year after that by hunters. And in fact, the main reason that you had harvest tickets of up to 6 deer for Kodiak and a Fognak is because the department had allowed the herds to grow so large that they were very fearful that huge winter kills would occur if we had bad snow conditions. They couldn't get enough hunters out there to kill enough deer to manage the herd and bring it back down to the size that they wanted. I think that's some incredible testimony about the competition between elk and deer on Fognak Island. It sounds to me like the elk have a much harder time than the deer do, and it sounds to me like the deer are doing very, very well out there. But I'm not a biologist.
Thank you, Senator. I'd like to thank the people that are waiting to give testimony. I'm sorry that we ran out of time on this issue. Next, we'll go to the Senate Bill 46, authorizing loose farming. Senator Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Mike Miller. I represent Senate District Q, and thank you for scheduling this. I will just be very brief and then turn it over to my staff as I am in the middle of a State Affairs Committee meeting on the Senate side. We're dealing with a special education, House Special Education Bill, and have a number of amendments to deal with. But just real briefly, what 46 does. 46 was introduced last year, both on the House side and the Senate side. I introduced it on the House side, and Senator Schultz introduced it on the Senate side. And this year, I have introduced it on the Senate side. And basically, 46 provides for the development of moose farming in Alaska, and it is intended to expand Alaska's economic development opportunities. And under Senate Bill 46, as passed by the Senate, DEC, DNR, and Fish and Game are given quite a bit of regulatory powers to ensure the safety and health of the animals and handlers, to provide for an adequate startup and monitoring of moose farming activities, and safeguards have been added to help prevent diseases, which has been a major concern of Fish and Game, and just to give a number of regulatory powers. Now, there are some differences in a proposed committee substitute that you have before you, and probably the major difference is not only is moose added to the list, but so is caribou, the ability to do more in the area with that. And it also transfers some of the regulatory powers from Fish and Game to DNR, which has and DEC, which has the state veterinarian. And the state veterinarian has been very supportive of this piece of legislation in the past, and he continues to do so. And that is a very brief synopsis of what it does. My staff is here that can explain the bill in more detail if she has put a number of hours into it. And there are a couple of individuals here, one from my district 33, and there's an individual here from Kenai, which has quite a bit of experience. I believe elk. And so they can give you a lot more of how it's done out there in the field, and a lot more of the technical support and testimony than I certainly could ever give you. But with that, I will conclude my testimony. And if there's any questions,
Senator Kearney, question. Representative Kearney.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Only one question. You say you include caribou. Why not reindeer?
Well, I understand that we do have a problem there with reindeer. The reindeer falls under the federal law. And I'm pretty sure that's the problem there. And reindeer is regulated by the feds.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Green?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would your concept here include hunting like the bison are up in the northern area, interior, or would this strictly be like the muskox where it's farmed in corralled areas and at the behest of the farmer?
Well, pretty much it would be, I think pretty much under most of this version, it would be a number of ways you can go. And I was just going back through and just rechecking some of the information in there, but you could have some of the animals available for slaughter. I think there's a number of different ways that it can go. I could even envision, and in fact, there have been some of the different native corporations which have contacted me, which have expressed interest in it, because they feel that this could be a way that they could create their own farms for moose for village needs. Mm-hmm. Of course, we all have we've all seen reindeer meat in the state of Alaska that's commercially done for sale, and maybe at a certain point you could do it with moose meat. I don't know. I mean, but the possibility is there. But at the same time, it's regulated to make sure that everything is done properly.
Just a follow-up question on that. Would this create a more difficult oversight to prevent poaching? I'm thinking that that was brought up in there.
That was brought up, but as long as you've got to, go through, the scenario, if somebody's going to, poach the game, to poach the game for their own private use, that could be tough to regulate. But I mean, they take moose out of season as it is now. So I mean, we still have that problem now. If you're taking the game to sell it or to sell it commercially, there's all the hoops that you have to go through, and you have to show who you're going to, that this is one of your moose that the Fish and Game DNR has the ability. You have to report whenever you slaughter an animal and things like this. So if they don't have the information where they have to go to have the animal slaughtered for it so it can be put up for sale, it won't happen. There's a trail back there.
Thank you. Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
We do have, as I understand, a few people from DNR, Fish and Game, DEC. Is there anybody here that would like to testify from those areas? If not, I'll call on next, Bill Ward. State your name and who you represent.
Thank you. My name is Bill Ward. I'm from Sadotna. I don't know if you people have had the opportunity to look at some information I had faxed in a few days back to be included in your packet. One was a cover letter giving you just a little bit of the background on myself, and also a fact sheet with respect to game farming that I think will help explain a lot of the issues from the game farming perspective. I raise elk on the Kenai Peninsula. I've been in agriculture since 1976. We brought our elk in 1990. We currently have 57 head and are increasing those numbers. I've also been very actively involved in the game farm industry throughout the United States and also internationally. I'm on the board of directors of a elk association that's an international association. I'm very familiar with all state laws, state regulations, and the current status of the industry. I've testified before USDA, U.S. Animal Health, the Animal Research, the National Research Council. And I've attended the World Deer Congress, where 23 nations came together to help formulate a game farm policy worldwide. Within this legislation, I'd like to speak to three points. My first point is with respect to the game farm regulation reform aspect that is in this bill. First question is, why am I even here? Elk is already fully authorized under ASO3. Of farming legislation, and it is under current legal ownership and regulation. But The reason I'm here is an industry will only develop, be it elk or any game farm industry, and only become strong, viable, and healthy and profitable if there is good regulatory legislation to support it, or to provide for a clean, healthy industry, a stable industry, and one that satisfies all those citizens that have any concerns about it. So I'm here to promote regulation. I'm here to promote regulating me. I'm here to promote regulation of anybody else that gets involved in this industry. The reason is this is I see what's happening in all the other states. It is only being successful and profitable in the states that have a good comprehensive regulatory structure behind it. It is also only stable and profitable in states that is being administered, where it's being administered by the Departments of Agriculture and not by the wildlife agencies. And the reasons for that are relatively obvious. First of all, game farming is agriculture. It is not wildlife at that point. When it goes behind a fence, it's an agricultural animal. It's raised for agricultural purposes. Also, with respect to who should be administering it, the Department of Fish and Game and wildlife agencies in general have came out in category and publicly stated they oppose game farming. They also, game wildlife agencies are not equipped, they're not qualified, and they have no interest in an agricultural animal. Fish and Game also has a very poor record of administering game farming in other states. And there's evidence to prove that, if you're concerned about the disease issue, the disease issue has only arisen in states under wildlife control. It has not come around in states under agricultural control, and that can be documented. Also, government agencies are there, and they have an obligation to assist private enterprise rather than hinder. The Division of Agriculture and the state veterinarian has made a commitment to provide the above points I mentioned. And Fish and Game has made a commitment and a public statement they oppose. They want to have a game farming eliminated. Point is, if the Department of Fish and Game has legitimate concerns or legitimate problems with wildlife, then they handle it as a government agency interdepartmentally, between departments, not come and try to harass private industry. As I stated, the Division of Ag and State Veterinarian, they have committed to building a good industry. I have spoken with them at length. I've met with their staff, and there are draft regulations already in place within the Division of Agriculture to cover game farming. They're comprehensive. They've taken from a lot of the issues, the controversy, what works in other states, what doesn't work. They're in place, and they're ready to do their job. To the extent in this bill, you'll see that a lot of the what normally would be regulations are going to be in here under statute. A lot of the regulatory pressure that's put on private industry is now will be in statute, not just regulation. The reason for that is because the industry, and I think the departments feel an obligation to show intent, and also to show the legislature that we're trying to address the concerns of the critics of game farming that have brought forth to you, and to show in law that we will follow what it takes to be a good, clean industry. What is incorporated in this bill is a compilation of industry coming together, talking with them, the agriculture, the state veterinarian, and also quite a bit of the fish and game input through their concerns. What's in here is legitimate and basically just amounts to good management. This regulation and legislation will be stronger than you'll find in any other state where the industry is in place. We recognize the need to maintain the health, to satisfy the public scrutiny and protect the welfare of the animals. And just Saturday, we had a game farm symposium where we offered a training session for anybody that's either in the industry or wanting to get into the industry to try to assist them in management techniques. The regulations in here are needed. They will promote a strong and viable and healthy game farm industry. The second point I'd like to speak to is with respect to the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. I guess I'll start with some words of praise, because I'm going to follow with words of criticism. And words of praise, I worked with Wayne Ragland for quite a few years. I knew him as a research station. I've talked to him at length recently. Chuck Schwartz is at the station now, I think Highway of him. And also, as a side note, I don't think you should cut the funding to the research center, the Moose Research Center down there. It's doing a good job, it provides very good data for wildlife management, and I think it should be kept in place. I also would like to speak highly of our local wildlife biologist, Ted Spraker. Ted is opposed to game farming, but Ted has given me a lot of assistance. And I would, real gratitude to Ted's help in the management of my game farm, because he likes the animals as well as I do. I believe the basic reason that the Department of Fish and Game is opposed to game farming just comes from a philosophical objection. They basically philosophically feel that the wild game species should not be under private ownership. That's legitimate, but it's a personal opinion. And everybody's allowed to have an opinion. But it does not mean that they can take their opinion and try to impose it on others. I want to strongly object to the tactics used by the department to stop the game farm industry, not only in Alaska, but everywhere. I feel they're very unprofessional and they're very improper as a state agency. The arguments they use are not legitimate and they're not honest. They distort the truth, they lie, they slander people. I think that's an improper use of state time, an improper use of state personnel. The main objections that they bring forth are disease, escapement, genetic pollution, poaching, and the diminishment of the quality of wildlife. With respect to disease, Alaska is clean of disease. The livestock are clean. We are very fortunate with our Arctic environment. Part of that is we have a state veterinarian who has some very strong regulations on import. They're tough. They're as tough as any place to get animals into this state. His record is good. He's not imported a lot of any diseased animals in. And Lord knows the game farmers don't want disease. Our economic future is at stake with disease. With reference to TB, the disease of choice that everybody likes to hammer on, there are facts. The facts have been presented in that fact sheet. I got the document where it came from. The facts are that game farmers do not spread disease to wildlife. There is no case in 90 years of history where a disease, the tuberculosis disease, has ever been spread from a private game farm to wildlife. There are two cases where deer in New York State contracted tuberculosis from affected dairy herds. And the point there is, when those dairy herds were depopulated, the disease and the wildlife also did not sustain itself and went away. It's not a disease that can run rampant. Those facts stand. There's issues stated with what they've done in Canada. I won't take the time to go in detail, but I can document that what you've been given is somewhat distorted in that issue. However, there is disease in wildlife. Disease is endemic in wildlife. It's a fact of life. The caribou have brucellosis. Where it came from, I don't know, and I'm not prepared to debate. But the facts are there is disease in caribou. The Department of Fish and Game moves animals out of those herds, and there is no obligation for them to test those animals. There's no mandatory obligation to test or quarantine. Some they test, but I'm sure there's some they don't. That puts a real legitimate concern to livestock as well as other wildlife where they're moved to. The difference is agriculture tests for disease, we monitor disease, we vaccinate, and we eradicate it when we find it. The other thing is fish and game doesn't look for disease. If they don't look for it, they don't find it. With respect to escape, the elk that I have right now have a market value of close to $250,000. You don't think I'm concerned about escape? I'd be a damn fool as a businessman if I did. There are regulations in place and being drafted right now by the Division of Agriculture to provide adequate fencing. The industry, primarily out of New Zealand, has very good technology to provide fencing to contain animals. Genetic pollution, let's let the geneticists debate that one. But you'll find all sorts of stories. Much of them referred to me is that you can put a drop in the ocean, but what are you going to do to the ocean? With respect to poaching, and it has been brought up in Alaska, this concern has been expressed in other states and other provinces by poaching that will occur after game farms come in place. It's a good concern, but it never has materialized in those states. it has subsequently not materialized. We can have regulations that require any game meat to be slaughtered in an inspector facility and that meat stamped, and then the subsequent meat can be followed with a stamp. And if it doesn't have a stamp on it, you're going to be in trouble. We can deal with it. With respect to the diminishing the quality of wildlife, it's one that I hold dear to my heart. I have a great respect for these animals, just like the biologists do. The point is, if I'm going to raise them for commercial purposes, they must be stress-free, they must be healthy, they must be comfortable to be productive and profitable for me. So it's in my best interest to maintain the quality of wildlife. I want to object to tactics that are used to subsequently try to impact people's position on game farming. Recently, the Alaska chapter of the Wildlife Society was given a position paper to consider and vote on. If they vote on it, they wanted to send it to all the legislators. There's a lot of untruth in here. If anybody's interested, I'll go through and debate every issue in this Wildlife Society position paper. I'd like to have an equal opportunity to present the facts. I will meet with Fish and Game to discuss any of these issues. I will sit with my experts on my side of the table. They can sit with their experts. But the point